Coming to you from the not-for-profit Mainframe Studios at 900 Keo Way in downtown Des Moines, this is 900 Views, a podcast about building community through the arts as we build an arts community. I'm your host, Pat Bodie. Today we are in Mainframe Studio 456 with mixed media artist, Texas native, Iowa Arts Fellow, and Graceland Arts Professor Julia Franklin. Yes, she is all those folks rolled into one. Her work digs deep into personal and community connections, as we're about to find out. She also has the dual perspective of working in the smaller academic arts community at her job in Lamoni, and at the same time being engaged a good deal of the time in the arts community that is Mainframe Studios. I asked her to compare and contrast those worlds.
Well, Graceland is situated in Lamoni, Iowa, which has a population of about 2,000 people, and it sits in Decatur County, which is the poorest county in the state of Iowa. So you can imagine the arts maybe aren't as flourishing as much as they are here in Des Moines. But there is an art community in Lamoni, and it's made up of people who probably wouldn't label themselves as artists. So there are knitters, huge community of knitters, people who are making all sorts of things. They're writing, they're chefs, they are creating and expressing themselves in very different ways. In terms of colleagues, I've found that there's only three people in our arts department, and they're doing amazing things with social practice and really trying to get the community involved there in Lamoni. But I'm finding that I'm making connections with colleagues across discipline. So one of my good friends, Dr. Brian Smith, is a psychologist there in Lamoni who teaches at Graceland. And we've partnered on all kinds of projects at the university to make things better. And so I found that collaborating with people outside of my discipline, especially folks in theater, have really helped my work to shift and to make connections with groups I normally wouldn't be involved with.
So how does that compare to kind of the scenario here at Mainframe, the arts community here?
Oh, the arts community here is so welcoming. It was just a huge blessing in a way to be able to get a space here and be able to create here because I did find a community of artists. I found that when I need inspiration, I can just pop down the hall and talk with Gretchen or Jess, any number of artists here, or they are willing to help me on some projects to make those happen. And it's wonderful with First Friday events here at Mainframe Studios to be able to see everybody kind of treating that as a monthly deadline and creating new work. And it's great to see people evolving and taking risks and trying new things.
Now you have, speaking of your work, you've done some amazing things just this year alone. You're an Iowa Arts Fellow and getting some real quality time, I think, in terms of this studio and producing some amazing pieces. One of those is Illuminated, and that was at a gas station in West Des Moines, an Olson Larson building, glassed in. You created these dinners. Tell me more, and I'm really curious about some of the more memorable moments of what seemed to be a real example of arts as community building.
Well, the OL Guild space is an old gas station, you're right, and it is glassed in, so three walls are glass, so it allows neighbors of the community and just people walking down the street to peer in and just be observers or voyeurs. But what was interesting is that I decided to use that space to recreate a 1970s-style dinner party and dining room space. So the nostalgia hooked people and kind of wondered what was going on. So it was really putting an ordinary everyday ritual, having dinner together, on public view. So with that setting, created a buffet, had a television in there playing old movies from VCR tapes, which were more 1980s. But then I invited the community to sign up on Facebook to be part of a free potluck dinner party on Tuesday evenings while it was on view. And what was incredible is that I would have just a few friends attend a dinner party, but most people seated at the table were strangers. And so it allowed us to actually connect with one another in ways that we normally would never get to do so. And one of the most memorable things was a dinner party with the estimable Mia Farrell, who works at the Des Moines Arts Center, and she is all about community-driven projects. But I asked them, people had questions, what do we bring? What do we bring? And I said, whatever is easiest for you, if convenience works. And that whole group of people, strangers and friends, decided all on their own to bring dishes that were memorable to them. So maybe it was their aunt's favorite dish that she would bring to potluck dinner parties as they were growing up. Or maybe some of them had working moms and they were the ones preparing dinners. And one of the favorite meals was Mia's hot dog casserole that she created when she was a little girl. And it was a concoction of hot dogs, cut-up hot dogs, in ketchup. And then as an adult, she's added, you know, some sugar and other sauces to make it actually a really tasty thing. But it was a great introduction for each other, for people who don't know each other, to say, I brought this dish, and this is why I brought it. And it told their own stories of who they were, and they were able to share memories of how that food had connected them to a place or person or event. And I mean, talk about deep conversations. And nobody pulled out phones. Everybody was engaged and really actively listening to one another. And it was one of the best art moments of my life.
That's really an outstanding story. What would you say, to the best of your ability to articulate it, would be a community impact from something like that? Strangers breaking bread and sharing really personal stories by inspiration by object.
You're right. It is something, and it was really by accident. The space was so passive when you just walked by and looked inside. And it felt empty and a little kind of creepy in a way, that there was something, that emptiness and that absence was somehow disturbing. And so it was just a fly-by-moment decision. Let's activate this space. Let's get people in here. Let's get them talking. And I think that's the impact, is that it wasn't intentional by design. And so there wasn't any great big motivation other than let's activate the space, let's get people in here and using it. And now it makes me want to do more. Like, how can I authentically do that in other spaces? Are there abandoned storefronts where we could do something similar? Because I think it's also important that that piece had people looking in on us, which made us be the art. So the guests and I and the space were art, or almost like zoo animals where people were observing us. But I think it's a way for people to pause and kind of wonder what we were doing, what we were talking about, and kind of maybe that desire to be part of that as well. Because I had other asks to be able to come in and use that space. And so I made that happen just by giving them a key. I had two photographers. Queen Kinsey is a rap artist who's going to be at 8035. She came in and did part of a hip-hop video in that space. And then Preston Magnum came in and did kind of an editorial photo shoot in their glamorous shots within the space. So by igniting kind of the community and sparking interest with what the space looked like and how people were using it, it allowed me to interact with photographers and musicians in ways I'd never expected.
And it activated that space for probably a much longer period of time beyond you, I would assume.
It did. And that idea that everything needed to be free, because I want the arts to be accessible, that is key. And I also wanted to create a space that would be welcoming. And I think the nostalgic atmosphere really connected with people, maybe their grandparents' homes or their own homes. And I think that was really an important part of that project.
So you have this great quote. I make art with discarded objects to tell the stories about the things we leave behind. What is the significance of what we leave behind and their associated stories?
Well, there's several bodies of work that deal with this, but I'm interested in what gets discarded, what gets forgotten, what gets lost, and what gets abandoned. And I think it's important because they're kind of crumbs of who we are. We're leaving these behind. And I happen to be interested in that. And I scavenge, I look, and I collect. And it tells an interesting story about what we value, maybe what we don't value. And then really kind of interested in those things that maybe perhaps are lost or forgotten, and that they are these sacred relics about us. And they are ordinary. They're usually dirty and well used. And it really shows us that we're actually extraordinary creatures. And there's all sorts of information in that one object. It does tell a story about the person who had it, that moment that it was lost or left behind. And it's just begging to have its story told, even though others would consider it to be trash and something unworthy. I think everything is full of worth and demands some attention.
I have this conflict within myself in that as a conservationist, you long for minimalism and strive not to acquire things. And yet I find your work deeply inspiring and not without its conservation, ecological, environmental bent. Can you marry those two things for me, help me understand better why I feel that conflict and resolve it?
Well, that's true. I am a hoarder, let's be honest. I need to acknowledge that I am a collector. As you look around the studio, every surface has a pile of objects and boxes full of things that I've collected over the years. But I think in terms of conservation that I'm reusing things, that I am trying to be responsible in the materials that I use as an artist. I'm trying not to create additional things. I am just trying to create displays for these objects so people do take them as significant sacred objects. But I think it's that I'm reusing what already exists in the world, and that I think there's great sense of conservation within that. But I would maybe use the word preservation, that I'm preserving history, that I am kind of using these as reminders of who we are and where we've been. And I think that's something that you can maybe come to terms with and see as a conservation or preservationist attitude.
You did great. I wonder if you can tell me more about how objects inspired this piece, Picking Up the Pieces, which is a pretty intense personal story of yours, how your father committed suicide when you were 16 and you wanted to try and understand him and know him as someone besides just being your dad.
Right. Well, Picking Up the Pieces is a project I actually never expected to tell. When my father committed suicide when I was 16, we stopped talking about him. It was such a shameful, unexpected, emotional moment that our family, to kind of heal and cope, kind of put it in the past and never addressed it. And so growing up from that day forward, everything was put away, moved away. We didn't speak of my dad. And this was for decades. It also divided our family, kind of between my mom's side and my dad's side. And so that changed dynamics. It changed friendships within the community. And it is something that was unexpected. But 25 years ago, apparently my dad's things got boxed up and given to family members. And my cousin Ruthie, my dad's niece, kept them. So they survived tornadoes and floods in Oklahoma. And a few years ago, she delivered them to me. And she delivered them to me after my mom had passed away, because I realized then that my mom had been the gatekeeper of our family history and that she had worked our whole lives to kind of protect us and shield us from what was really going on. So when Ruthie brought me this box of my dad's belongings, I didn't know they existed. And so Wow. It was just this treasure trove of things. And they were just everyday things. Some ties, cufflinks, letters, his handkerchiefs. And so that was extraordinary to see to see my dad come alive again. I remembered those ties. He always wore a collared shirt and a tie and slacks every day. He never owned a pair of pants. And so it was a way for me to remember him. And then this project is really a way to honor him and really deal with those emotions and those memories in a way that I hadn't gotten to in almost 30 years now. So Picking Up the Pieces was an interactive exhibition. It was held at Graceland University, and it took over 2,400 square feet where I recreated rooms from my childhood as best as I could remember, and then also put out these photographs of my dad, the letters of my dad, to really kind of put out there, maybe to help understand who he was, a timeline of his life, but also to show the depth of him as a person and how complicated things really were. He was depressed. I didn't know that. We were in huge debt and about to lose our house and car. Again, something hidden from a 16-year-old child. And then I found, as I was reading through letters and then as people came forward to tell stories, that my dad was mostly in the closet. He had confided in another cousin that he was gay, and that cousin held that confidence until 3 years ago and thought it was time for us to understand the dynamics that were going on at home that we were oblivious to. And so this was a way for me to understand my dad, honor him, give him that legacy, kind of really show how much he shaped my life and how much I loved and adored him. And I know he loved and adored us, but it was a way for me to come to terms and kind of find forgiveness in this whole project. So it's a public therapy session.
Yeah, but I think it went well beyond that, because clearly a lot of people related to this in so many levels, in so many ways. People who have dealt with suicide, you've spoken with the LGBTQ community and with One Iowa. You were part of that Fun Home conversation. You've done some amazing work to use this as a dialogue, a way for others to reflect on similar situations. Tell me how that has had an impact on you, being able to use this in a way that isn't just about you.
Well, talking about memorable moments, there were so many conversations that were memorable where art was kind of the bridge that connected people to tell their stories. So people had the courage to come forward and confess things that they haven't talked about to anyone else. And so they were willing to share that with me. And I find that just so precious, and want to hold those confidences. But I also invited viewers to write letters. I had our mailbox on the wall and our 1524 address sign there, and invited viewers, if they wanted to take a moment to write me a note. Since letters were such a heart of the show, that idea of writing, which came from my dad, even myself. And so they shared, even in letters, if they didn't feel comfortable talking to me, they could express it in another way. And to realize that people were dealing with loss, that they were dealing with suicide, they were dealing with their own identity in a world that maybe wasn't as accepting as they wanted it to be. And I think that it's an amazing experience to feel like you have an ally with someone else who's been through those moments where you don't feel so alone. And I'm so glad I could connect with people in such a deep way.
You know, one of the things I'm discovering as I do this podcast about building community through the arts, as we build an arts community, is the real importance of the form of the interactions. You've developed this great way of really inviting people literally into a space and to share some real intimacy. How did you come to decide that that kind of highly interactive form was going to be such a strengthener for community and the personal stories and conversations that lead to connections?
There's a quote by Klaus Oldenburg from the 60s where he says, "I'm tired of seeing sculpture sit on its ass in a museum." And it's one of those that got me thinking when I read it over 20 years ago. You're right, art is very passive. How do we get it outside of a museum? outside of a gallery? How do we get people to interact and participate? And so for the last 20 years, I've been creating kind of those experiences, changing environments to get people to pay attention. And with that, how do you understand loss truly if it's just hanging on a wall? But if you create a space that actually feels empty, where you see chairs, where you see belongings, but no one may be who those belong to in that space, there's something strong there. And by using found objects, those are authentic. I have the ability to recreate whatever I want in clay or bronze, whatever. But there's something about that original object that has history and meaning and power that I can't recreate. So when I use furnishings found at thrift stores, even if they're not my own, there's still something where they belonged to a person, and a little bit of that person is along with that object, and then they all combine in that space. And I think it's important that when you're walking around and when you're allowed to open drawers and go through files and documents and actually touch and read things, it becomes intimate. And I think that's what we need. We need to have those intimate moments where we can connect with others, but really connect with ourselves, where it gives us moment for pause to reflect on our own past and to make meaning of that, and then how it relates to what we're seeing and experiencing.
In other words, community building isn't just shoulder-to-shoulder work. A lot of it's internal, so that you can, in fact, do the shoulder-to-shoulder work later. I'm sure I'm not the first person to observe that your work really smacks of William Carlos Williams' famous quote, "No ideas but in things." When you look at these things and your curiosity gets the better of you, you've got things. You're saying, "I'm always looking at my feet and wondering how something got there."
Mm-hmm.
So to what extent is your imagination part of some of this work? The story of your father was documented.
Mm-hmm.
But these other pieces that you run into and that you work with, how much of the stories that you're creating are right out of your head?
Well, imagination has to do a lot with that, because you have to start asking, what if? And why? And then there's that level of invention and that level of play, where there's curious inquiry and trying to figure out, how did this get here? And inventing stories. Is it something sad and tragic? Is it something funny? Is it just an accident on how that object got there on my bike ride or my walk through the woods? And yeah, it's just a marker for the idea that someone was here and they left a mark, maybe unintentionally, but that I noticed. And it's a way for me to say, I acknowledge you, and I'm glad you were here, and I'm glad we connected, even if it's through this discarded object.
One more project I just want to touch on, because I was so taken by it when I saw it on your website. It wasn't something I had known about until I started to look at your work more deeply. And that was the piece where you found your grandfather's red garden bench. Of course, speaking of William Carlos Williams, kind of smacks of the red wheelbarrow. I get it. And your daughter, you guys go out in the woods and you end up with all this coolness. Can you tell a little bit about what that meant to you and your daughter to have that experience together? And it's a really powerful, I think, piece that resulted.
Sure. That was a show called Landscapes that I was fortunate enough to do at Graceland years ago. My daughter was 4 at the time. She's now 16. But if you've ever been on a walk with a 4-year-old, you know you don't go very far, and that your pockets are full of all kinds of bizarre things, because everything is interesting and fascinating to a 4-year-old. And so the way it kind of tied in with my grandfather's, I'd been on a visit to see my sister and noticed that weeding bench and thought, I need that. Can I borrow it? Can I have it? I don't know why, but I piled it in the back of my car. I also had an old red wagon from when we were growing up, and that was in the back of the car. And when we got back from Texas, my daughter and I started going on these walks in our neighborhood down in Lamoni, and we started to collect enough things that I thought, let's pull out that wagon. Let's go on walks together, and let's collect our neighborhood as a way to kind of document that. And when we did, we had a Dollar General store there in town, and I literally bumped into stacks of canning jars and decided, oh, that could be a great container for these cool things that we're collecting from our landscape. And so my daughter and I loaded up a wagon full of glass jars. So imagine the rattling and the clinking on those trucks around the neighborhood. But we were sorting the neighborhood. We were kind of seeing it with new eyes. Even though it was a neighborhood with houses, there were still all these cool natural objects that existed. And when I thought about those jars, I did tie that back to my grandfather. And my grandfather mowed his lawn every other day. He would be out on that weeding bench with scissors trimming grass.
Oh, my gosh.
So that it was all even. But he also had a storage shed where he hung all of his nails and screws from jars, and they were actually screwed in from underneath the shelves.
So that's why that was the aspect you chose for your display.
It was, and it just kind of all happened again, just, you know, by chance. But those jars hung from the bottom side of shelves, and as a kid, I thought it was magic. I didn't understand the lids were screwed to the bottom of the shelf. It was just the coolest thing ever. So kind of thinking about back to my past and my experiences with my grandfather and his yard work and gardening, and then being out in nature with my daughter kind of really brought the past and the present together for me. And my daughter and I even put grass in the gallery. I ordered sod and it was delivered. And here's 4-year-old Skye rolling out sod in a gallery to create a carpet of grass where we brought the outside inside. And it was such a great project to work on with her. And that reminder that everything is fascinating if we just stop and look.
Well, and I must say, I got a funny feeling it may have been inspiring to Skye. What's she doing right now?
She's actually in Washington, D.C. at the National Youth Summit on the Environment.
So I just thought that was worth noting.
Yeah. Yes, it might have stuck with her, too.
Yeah. So just real quick, in spring 2020, you have an anticipated project, Belongings, an Immersive Installation and Performance. And so you'll be doing some community building in Oskaloosa, Iowa. Anything quickly you'd like to share about that upcoming?
Well, I just received an Iowa Arts Council project grant, which is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, to make that happen, because Oskaloosa has this hotbed of the arts happening in this rural community and in Mahaska County. And the Oskaloosa Arts Center combines community theater with an art exhibition space, along with art education and classes. And so I'm teaming up with Emily Ott, the director of the Oskaloosa Arts Center, and we are going to make a play happen. I'd written a play called Keeping Up Appearances about the day my father died, and then the decades later discovery of all of the bizarre events that were really happening at that time. And I'm going to adapt it for that space. And it should be an immersive experience where the audience can travel with the actors as the story unfolds in those spaces.
Julia, I can't thank you enough. This has just been fascinating. And I hope to get down to Oskaloosa to see that and keep track of all that you have ahead. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Pat.